Welcome back. This is the Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. Christopher Dickey certainly lives there, breathes there, reports from there. Bill Russell and I are delighted to be with you, Mr. Dickey.
The Outer Limits.
Well, what you say about New York, that the NYPD, the New York Police Department, not the public library, though also this, really put this, the diversity in the best sense of the word of New York to work. If you know anything about Arabs, Arabs like to talk. Where did we lose all of the, as Bill was saying earlier, the context and the granularity? These things are just intuitively obvious.
Well, they are obvious, but there's a whole sort of mindset in the United States government and in the media and in the sort of the message that's put out to the media to say, all these people are crazy. You can't deal with them. I'm not saying all Arabs, although there are some people who will tell you that. But they'll certainly say that anybody who's thinking about being a terrorist, who could talk to these people? They're obviously deranged. And there is a complete denial of any kind of cause and effect. If you mention cause and effect, a lot of people will talk to you and say, well, you're being an apologist for the terrorist. No, you're just trying to figure out what drives them, what makes them tick. And certainly at the level of the NYPD, trying to defend the world's number one terrorist target, New York City, they want to know what makes these guys tick. So they study them at every level. But mainly, they try and get close to the culture they come from.
If you're trying to prevent rather than react after the event, you have to get inside the heads of the people who are likely to commit these crimes.
Of course you do. Of course you do. You have to understand the sources of their anger, the sources of their personal problems. You have to look at the way they organize. And actually, the NYPD did a very controversial study that came out in summer of 2007 called Radicalization in the West, which was, I think, very badly presented to the public, and particularly to the Muslim communities of New York. But there are some really interesting lessons to be learned from it. One of the things that it did was they sent analysts from the intelligence division to all the places where there were what seemed to be homegrown terrorist plots to see how they happened and if there were any kind of patterns that you could see that were being replicated again and again. And I'm not saying that it would stand up to the most rigorous peer review in academia, but it does have a couple of insights that are extremely useful. And to me, the most important is that when you've got what they call a group of guys, just a parenthesis here, one of the things I love about the cops is that you don't get lost in definitions. It's like, what is terrorism? You never hear that discussion. This is about stopping the bad guys, right? So you have a group of guys who are getting increasingly radicalized. They're seeing stuff on the web or DVDs of atrocities by Christians against Muslims, by Israelis against Muslims. Some of the stuff is real, some of the stuff is totally doctored. A lot of it is grotesque to watch. And they are stoking their anger about Iraq, another subject. They're not dangerous when they go to the mosque. That's not the problem. The thing that the police are looking for is when they withdraw from the mosque. When all of a sudden they don't want to hear any more mainstream Muslim views, they don't want any equivocation by people who are saying Islam is the way of peace, not of violence, of which there's a lot of people. They don't want to hear that. So when you have a group of three or five or six guys that you all of a sudden see, the community sees, withdrawing like this, that's when you know you've got a problem. And that's where, from the NYPD's point of view, they want to move in.
Danny Colson, years ago, you probably know Danny Colson from way back.
He was at the FBI. And was number two at the FBI and was at Ruby Ridge and some of those really dreadful mm-hmm. places.
Told us years ago, this was before,
long before
9/11, but it was after Timothy McVeigh. Mm-hmm. And he argued forcefully, and you actually open your book with this, the difference between a soldier and a policeman.
Mm-hmm.
And he argued forcefully, looking principally at domestic terrorism, terrorists, that they, you know, if you treat them as criminals.
Exactly.
Rather than as soldiers or terrorists or all these other things. And just look at the crime and look at the, use the standard methodology. And he went on to say, by and large, crimes are solved because somebody tells you who did it.
Mm-hmm.
Not because you drop a nuke on them. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that that goes to the heart of why the New York Police Department, was successful in ways that the global war on terror, capital W, capital T.
The GWAT.
What an unfortunate acronym.
He says contemptuously that one has been, by all accounts, very successful, and the other has been, by, I think, a reasonable analysis, an abysmal failure, and has been actually counterproductive, that being the GWAT. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that that's at the heart of what you're talking about, that a police department that had extraordinary resources, both economic but also in terms of people and the community of which they were part, have been able to succeed in ways that the federal government, particularly with huge resources, again, economic principle in this case, has not been successful.
Well, that's right. Look, the NYPD is huge for a municipal police department. It's enormous. It's about 35,000 cops. I think the city of Atlanta has 2,000 cops. I mean, you've got Fulton and Cobb County and then MARTA, and there's other cops floating around, but there's 35,000 cops in the NYPD, 17,000 civilians. It's almost a $4 billion annual budget. They've got a lot of resources, but compared to the federal government, they are lithe and nimble and lean, and they are able to move much more quickly, and it also is very hierarchical in the sense that you've got the mayor, police commissioner, and then the commissioner's guys, Cohen, Falkenrath, these guys, and it goes like that. I was just meeting with some staffers on the Hill for the Department of Homeland Security Committee, the Republican side of it, and we were talking about this, and they were saying, yeah, look, the Department of Homeland Security, it's got about 535 bosses. It's got bosses everywhere you look, and everybody wants a piece of it and wants to do something with it. So the NYPD
that would be the House of Representatives and the Senate and the President.
Exactly. And so this is a much more nimble organization, and in fact, Kelly was able to turn it almost on a dime. You know, he came in and said, our mission is prevention. Now, by 2002, the FBI was saying the same thing. But its institutional culture was almost impossible to turn around, and still is very difficult to turn around.
Please say about the FBI's essential, the difference. I'm not going to say it because I want you to say it. The difference in the way that the FBI, that has lots and lots of lawyers who have become FBI agents.
Well, and let me just say, Kelly took issue with something I said the other day when he said, you know, we're not breaking the Constitution. You don't know how many lawyers we've got in the NYPD. They've got a lot of lawyers, but they don't have the culture, the legal culture or legalistic culture of the FBI. And the FBI was essentially created around the idea that you prosecuted cases, and that any evidence you gathered was essentially about gathering evidence for prosecution, and that the fact of prosecution would have its own deterrent effect. Now, if you're dealing with people who are going to blow themselves up, they don't really give a damn about the fact of prosecution. They're not going to be around for the trial. So you've got to get into that. You've got to penetrate that those networks much, much earlier. Now, I'm not saying that the FBI doesn't do that. It does. There was a case here in Atlanta a couple of years ago that was related to things all over the map, and it still hasn't come to trial. And that was an FBI case, essentially. But the NYPD said immediately, we're not about prosecuting. The intelligence division of the NYPD is the only part of the police that's exempted from the computer statistics program for which the NYPD is famous, where it's all about accountability, it's all about arrests, it's all about
cops on dots.
Intelligence division, they don't have CompStat. They're not part of that because nobody wants to hold them accountable for some kind of numbers game involving arrests. And when they arrest people, it's really to use the coercive power of the police to recruit informers. Around the intelligence division, I was amazed when I was there at one point and they were talking about getting people who sit on two seats at the same time. I said, what are you talking about? They said, look, when we've got somebody that we think is part of one of these groups of guys, maybe they've withdrawn from the mosque, it's people that we think are starting to get seriously dangerous, potentially, we'll follow one of them onto the subway. will send a uniformed cop, a white shield, up to him, and he'll say, you know, it's illegal to sit on two seats at the same time in the subway of New York City. And the guy's, what? He says, yep, you're coming down to the station with us. Then you get him down to the station, and you say, you know, we know about you. We know about your friends. What are they going to think if we tell them you've been down here talking to us? And so you start this game of intimidation, cooperation, complicity, source building, and you basically recruit informers using the coercive power of the police. I'm not telling you that's a nice thing. It's not. But it's been used in the criminal world to fight crime for a long, long, long time. And it's something that the FBI really cannot do and the CIA really cannot do. Local cops can do it, and if they're as smart as the NYPD, they can do it effectively.
The difference between crime and terror is something I want to come back to in just a moment. Bill Russell, I, Paula Gordon, Christopher Dickey, please may you be with us too.